Hey, what's up? You're listening to They Came From the only podcast where we drag Hollywood and all of your favorite filmmakers on a white-knuckle hell ride across the frozen tundra of Canada's TC. We're not cynical. We're not contrarian. We're Canadian. On tonight's episode, we examine this career of cinematographer/director Peter Himes. With me, as always, our fellow knuckleheads Steve Power and Andrew Forbes.
Yo.
Plus American traitor Michael McVeigh, who's filling in for Gabrielle, who felt a vacation in beautiful Vienna was more important than discussing the greatest role in Telly Savalas' storied career.
He's gone sovereign again.
So, without further ado, grab your popcorn and your alcohol, kiddos. We're going to the movies. Peter Himes, unsung visualist or relic of the decade of decadence?
Not relic.
We haven't even started yet.
Come on. Made a movie called The Relic. It's hilarious.
Oh, okay.
I see what you did there.
Stay tuned.
Quit. Don't spoil my bad.
All right.
If only we were recording this in 2010.
If only we weren't recording this at all.
This truly is the end of days.
Outland! Sorry.
Silence, all of you.
Man, we need a time cop in here.
What was that? I just heard something. Was it the sound of thunder?
Of thunder? No, it
stop.
Was...
All of you, stop.
Now I'm running scared.
Peter Himes was born in New York City in the summer of 1943 to a Russian Jewish family already linked to the entertainment industry. His maternal grandfather was none other than Sol Hurok, the Ukrainian impresario, did I pronounce that properly?
Yes.
Who famously brought the Russian Bolshoi Ballet Troupe and members of the Kirov Academy of Ballet to the United States several times during the height of the Cold War. Himes studied both art and music at Syracuse University and Hunter College before beginning his career as an anchorman, photographer, and producer for several television stations, including a lengthy tenure at CBS. Following a brief fascination with documentary filmmaking, Himes moved to Los Angeles in 1971, where he quickly sold his first screenplay, the Herbert Ross-directed drama T.R. Baskin. For the next 7 years, Himes continued to work exclusively in the television medium. However, in 1978, he made his feature film debut with the critically praised conspiracy thriller Capricorn 1, about a crew of astronauts who are forced into covering up a botched attempt at a manned space mission to Mars. His follow-up, a World War II romantic drama starring a still-hot from Star Wars, but not yet megastar Harrison Ford, found solid footing at the box office, and has since grown quite a cult following amongst aviation enthusiasts due to its stunning aerial photography. In 1981, Himes scored another well-received film with the Sean Connery vehicle Outland. Advertised as a deep space take on High Noon, the film pitted Connery's federal marshal against corrupt corporate bureaucracy and lethal assassins on a mining colony set on Io, one of Jupiter's four moons. 1983 brought the Michael Douglas thriller The Star Chamber, which, despite some extremely positive reviews, failed to capture much of a theatrical audience. In 1984, Himes either bravely or foolishly took on a role that I'm sure many would rather have not had, adapting and directing the sequel to Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey, 2010, the year we make contact. This was made with the blessing of Kubrick and the assistance of its original writer, novelist Arthur C. Clarke. The film scooped up roughly double its budget, and many critics admitted that if viewed free from comparison to its predecessor, it was indeed an exciting and well-made science fiction epic. In a move usually reserved for Ridley Scott, Himes decided to avoid returning to the sci-fi well, and instead made his next picture, the 1986 buddy cop actioneer Running Scared, which set the bizarre pairing of dancer-slash-actor Gregory Hines and popular Saturday Night Live alumni Billy Crystal off the chain as a pair of loose cannon cops looking to put away a raw Colombian drug runner who aims to become Chicago's next Al Capone before they retire to the sun and surf of Florida's Key West. Like much of Himes' output during the time, it was a mild hit, but paled in comparison with similar fare such as 48 Hours and the forthcoming Lethal Weapon. Himes closed out the 80s with a similar thriller, reuniting him with actor Sean Connery, who was hot off his Oscar win for The Untouchables, for The Presidio, a murder mystery set on a San Francisco military base. 1990 brought Narrow Margin, a loose remake of the 1952 Richard Fleischer classic that we discussed last week. Well, 2 weeks ago. Despite a strong performance from Gene Hackman, this movie remains one of the more elusive films of Himes' catalog. Switching gears again in 1992, he tried his hand at black comedy with Stay Tuned, a hamstrung tale of a suburbanite couple who find themselves trapped in a television loop. The film is best remembered for a short animated sequence directed by the legendary Chuck Jones, and not much else.
Dwayne's Underworld.
If Peter Himes was hungry for a hit, he'd get it in 1994 with Time Cop, starring an at-the-time explosively popular action star in Jean-Claude Van Damme, as a federal agent diving through time in pursuit of a bloodthirsty politician dead set on murdering his way to the White House. It was Van Damme and Himes' first movie to break the $100 million mark at the box office. The pair reteamed in 1995 for Sudden Death, one of the 90s' many diehard clones, this time set during Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals. While not quite the smash that Time Cop was, it still doubled its budget and went on to become quite the hit on the home video market, who were still hungry for action offerings as the genre began to dry up following the late 80s, early 90s boom era. Switching gears again in 1997, Himes directed The Relic, a gory monster movie based on the international bestseller by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child, and set entirely within Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History. The movie was met by critical division and mild box office reception, even if it did score an unexpected glowing review from Siskel and Ebert. On advice from his friend James Cameron, Arnold Schwarzenegger sought Himes to helm 1999's End of Days, a dark actioneer that pitted an older, slightly more grizzled Austrian oak against Satan himself during the millennium hysteria of New Year's Eve in 1999. Reviews were almost unanimously negative. Moviegoers hit the theaters in droves, driving End of Days receipts past the $200 million mark. The 2000s were a quieter decade for the aging Himes, with the poorly received The Musketeer in 2001, and then the 1-2 punch of delayed bombs with The Sound of Thunder in 2005, and Beyond a Reasonable Doubt in 2009. Since then, Peter Himes has loaned his considerable talent as a cinematographer, a role he performed personally on many of his own films, to his son John for his reboot of the flagging Universal Soldier franchise, which lit up the home video market in 2009. Himes has announced a return to the screen in 2013, where he'll once again reunite with Jean-Claude Van Damme for a third time as a director with the upcoming Enemies Closer. With that, let's begin. It's Himes time. Who wants to go first as we explore or the good, the bad, and the ugly of director Peter Himes?
Me. I guess no one was saying anything. I'll go first.
Okay. Against my better judgment, we'll start with Andrew.
this one's going to be a bit brief because I already talked about this movie at some length during one of our previous casts about movies I'd seen recently, and that is Outland.
Yay.
Which is awesome. It's Sean Connery, really good lead performance. It's a really smart, really simple plot in a very cool location. It's extremely tense. The special effects are very cool. The cast across the board is really good, especially Peter Boyle and James Secking and Francis Sternhagen. Who's like super sarcastic and cynical and is probably the best single character in all of Peter Himes' filmography. Very sort of action-packed and extremely atmospheric. It has that sort of characteristic Peter Himes dark shafts of light kind of look, polished surfaces, but everything's a little bit grimy. Really, really cool.
I'm going to jump in here as well because I picked Outland as my good.
Yeah,
quite enjoy it. Of course, the science doesn't make
no
heck of a lot of sense there. It is
very much a science fiction movie in the vein of like the late 70s or early 1980s, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's very entertaining.
It is a Western in space.
Talking about a movie from the decade that gave us solar babies.
True.
And Knight Riders.
But, I mean, the thing it does do is it sort of – it's one of those movies where the science may not make sense, but it creates a believable world of bullshit science.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
It definitely
it's
does.
Consistent bullshit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you know, dudes' heads explode, which is always pretty rad.
One of Connery's better performances, too.
Mm-hmm. He was sort of at that stage where he hadn't – he, you know, the Bond days were over, and he hadn't yet gotten the superstar resurgence of – that would come 9 years later. So he's kind of in that middle – kind of middle-aged, weary – really working to actually give really strong performances as opposed to just being sort of that movie star presence.
He was hungry again. He was starting to grasp again, you know? Mm-hmm. Which was nice to see. I mean, after shit like Zardoz, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You watch your mouth. Zardoz is beautiful.
Zardoz is beautiful for me to poop on.
I forget which is good, but John Pickiness.
And I always remember seeing Outland in the video stores when I was a kid because it was in one of those great big Warner Brothers clamshells.
Yep.
And man, those things were attention getters. They were twice the size of everything else on the shelf.
And they always only had like one simple screenshot. It was the Outland case was, you know, that black clamshell, and it was just Sean Connery with a shotgun.
Yep. It says it all, really.
And the super awesome logo that could have only came out of the early 80s.
Actually, I think the original release didn't even have the logo because they used to just put everything on it in Times New Roman. All the titles used to just be written above the screen pit, like the image in Times New Roman.
Jesus. But
well, I eventually
picked it up to watch it, I remember being legitimately shocked at just how dark it was. Right? And I mean, yeah. It's a splendidly violent movie.
And like now, there's some sort of like strained laughs between characters, but everyone in it is just like tired and beaten down and
haggard, really haggard.
Yeah.
I've noticed that
it's the only movie where you're like,
I think a tour on Io is shit for anyone.
Mm-hmm. Right?
I mean, they're out there playing squash, and Sean Connery doesn't even look like he's having fun doing that.
Yeah.
Mike, you were saying something?
Yeah, somebody's mentioned Times New Roman before. I was actually making note that he's a – you know how certain directors favor certain fonts? Like Wes Anderson's known for Future or whatever the heck it is. I've noticed Peter Himes favors one of those lighter Helvetica's. You know, it just pops up in every movie. You know, while I was cramming for this episode, I started noticing that. I went way back to Capricorn 1, which is a movie I barely just finished, you know, 2 seconds before you pressed record. And, you know, the first thing I noticed on the list is Helvetica, check.
This is why you should not be recording podcasts in the sign shop.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, my boss has just left the building. The shop is all to myself. I think I'm going to run the printer, make an Outland banner hanging in my room.
I think I'm going to print a large format Outland sign.
a big coroplast cutout of Sean Connery and his shotgun.
I think it's kind of scary that all four of us on the podcast this evening have design backgrounds.
What you should do,
graphic
Mike,
designers, ramble about movie fonts.
You should print out the poster for Time Cop and the poster for End of Days and post them on opposite walls so that Van Damme and Schwarzenegger are just glaring at each other.
Do not walk into the middle of the
if doing it, break the tension, put the Sean Connery cutout from Outland on the back of your door, so every time you close the door, it's like, quiet, you two.
If I am going to print out a Van Damme Coroplast cutout, it is certainly going to be the I can do a split no problem on the sink Van Damme.
That was like the iconic image from the trailers for that movie. I remember.
It was, yeah. It definitely was.
I tried to ask while I beat up this bad guy.
I thought the mullet was the iconic image.
No, the mullet was the iconic image from Hard Target.
Yeah.
The slow motion hair whip.
Time Cop's just a semi mullet. Right?
Yeah.
Not full mullet.
I think is that he finished filming Hard Target and he couldn't bring himself to cut it off. Hard Target was a bit of a hit for him, and it's like maybe it's the mullet.
Is it my hair? I think so.
People like seeing a hairier, greasier Van Damme. No more pink shorts and ridiculous tank tops.
Oh god.
So anyway,
which one of the five movies where he plays his own twin brother was that again?
Oh yeah, Double Impact.
There's so many movies with duplicate Van Dammes. It's ridiculous.
I almost picked Outland, I almost picked The Relic, I should say, for my good, because I really like The Relic, but I too also went with Outland. Not to like drag you guys away from the Van Damme conversation.
No, please, we have to be dragged away.
Outland has plenty to offer.
Outland is just, for me, it was just a lean, you know, like quick, brief flowing, you know, like it worked really, really well for what it was. It was just a simple, gritty, science fiction-y tale. And in many regards, it kind of reminded me of like the first half hour or 40 minutes of Alien in its tone and stuff, you know? Only with that Western action thrown in there. So like,
it helped that the way that the titles came up was pretty much a direct ripoff of Alien.
Yeah. Those effects were fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The paintings in Outland are shockingly good.
Yeah.
You can only really see it on the Blu-ray.
Oh, the Blu-ray is gorgeous. Absolutely beautiful.
The DVD's got a horrible, horrible transfer. I think it's just directly ripped off of the VHS.
Gross.
And it's just... The matte paintings are incredible.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful looking movie, man.
And the nice thing about the Blu-ray,
for something that came out of the early 80s and didn't have the budget of Blade Runner.
Yeah.
What's interesting, somebody mentioned Alien. It's got that Alien vibe.
It really does. It really does.
Well, part of that, especially in the opening credits, I think Andrew just mentioned that, and Steve, you too, it's got that Jerry Goldsmith score.
It does, yeah.
Which is very, very much, Alien. I rewatching it after many, many years, I thought, oh my goodness, I did not, as a youngster, I did not, draw that parallel, but I mean it's pretty glaring there.
Yeah,
I remember, it's working stiffs in space.
Yeah, it's got, you know, like instead of the truckers in space, it's longshoremen, you know, or
and cops.
Yeah, you know, it's still that, you know, that blue collar employee.
It's rig workers.
Yeah, roughneckers.
I was doing my prep work for this for the Himes introduction. I read a. It was a review from the early 80s when it first came out in theater, and somebody actually made the comparison, said he found it a little more creepy than Alien, because instead of the slime-covered monster, you know, the monster
slime
in the movie...
Slime-covered Peter Boyle?
You know, the monster in the movie was man. You know, the killer is wearing the spacesuit behind you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a way, in Alien, it's...
pretty true of Alien as well, but...
Yeah, exactly.
Slightly more indirect way.
Yeah. I mean, I can't take anything, like, Outland really doesn't take anything away from Alien, but it's still, like, in its own way.
It's a very double feature.
It got made because of Alien.
Yeah, and in its own way, it's
ambitious, but it's...
It's every bit in its own way, like, on its own kind of, on its own standing, on its own ground, it's every bit as effective as Alien.
Oh,
but it owes a lot to Alien.
Oh my god, yeah, totally derivative. But, you know, like, just on its own, like, standing on its own, it's every bit as effective, you know?
Yeah.
It's more of a Stern. More of a mystery plot, right?
Yeah.
Well, hiding an air duct.
Plus Sean Stephen Burkoff freaking out.
What did you have, Jeff?
My good?
Yeah.
Not really a switching of the gears here, because again, it's another, you know, creepy horror-style movie. I actually did go with The Relic.
Ooh.
Now, see, I gotta say, I'm just gonna jump in right away and say I fucking love this movie.
And I was fucking pumped in, was it 97? I believe summer 97?
It was January 97.
January 97, sorry. That's right, it was just that, yes, because the previews were running on, like, Escape from L.A. and everything.
Yeah.
I was fucking pumped for this movie, because I just finished reading the book, and I'm not even a Preston and Child fan at all. But, you know, I just finished the book, thought it was amazing, thought the movie looked great, you know, and it helps that the Relic actually had a really, really cool trailer.
It had a great trailer.
And I, coming up again from a design background and being a design geek like that, I love the way the title comes up at the end of the trailer with the fangs closing.
Yeah.
But it, no, the movie was awesome, and it kind of kicked off this weird era where, you know, Tom Sizemore could have been a movie star.
Oh, that went wrong.
What is it? What was that statement?
It seems to have Linda Hunt on screen. She's fucking delightful in The Relic.
Her and the guy from Shawshank, what was his name? The old guy.
Brooks from
Shawshank? Yeah, Brooks from Shawshank. He played like the curator of the museum.
James Whitmore.
Whitmore. And, I mean, both of them, like, those two characters were absolutely fantastic. And Penelope
I'm really
Miller
surprised
was...
we haven't brought it up yet, because it's always a joke that comes out when anyone mentions Peter Himes, is how sparse his sets are of extras.
Yep.
You know, empty streets and everything.
Yep.
Outside of a couple scenes, The Relic is pretty much set entirely within the museum.
And it's pretty packed, too.
It's pretty packed. Yeah. But I love, you know, you get this great build-up going in of, you know, just the random monster attacks, everything, people trying to figure out what's going on. And then when they go ahead with the grand opening, the big gala, and then the SWAT team get introduced, and then they all get locked in there with, what is it called, the Cthoga?
The Cthoga.
And the movie goes completely batshit fucking insane with blood.
It does. It really does.
Sepatone blood.
I always remember the poor guy who gets pulled in through the skylight, and when he's like, you know, screaming for someone to pull him out. When they pull him out, they just pull up his torso.
Yeah.
And then the hilarious, like, no!
Yeah, and the other guy reaches both hands into the air and just lets out the big old, ah! But it just, what a great monster, too, man. Stan Winston strikes again, you know. You had this thing that was like a cross between a rhinoceros and the Predator.
Winston wanted to make his own version of the Chimera.
Yeah.
Stan, instead of going like something cheesy, like lion, snake, eagle, he said, you know, how many fucking ways can I fit a scorpion on this? He gave a rhinoceros a spider's face. Everyone hates spiders, so Stan Winston made one that, you know, weighed...
Spinoceros.
Spinoceros.
That was a better name than the Cthuga. My wife and I sat down...
Arachnosaurus?
And she had never seen it before and was loving it, right?
Yeah.
It's just, the movie is absolutely relentless.
Yeah.
And I really, really fret that Himes didn't direct more horror, because he's really good at it.
One thing I love about The Relic, I love the look of the movie. It's just this black on black. Everything is so dark.
That's Himes' trademark.
Yeah, but no, I mean, this takes it and amps, like, the blackness to 11. You know, it's just...
Yeah, and then in End of Days, he pushed it to 12.
Yeah, well, no,
didn't know what was happening.
End of Days was just murky looking, but The Relic is just, you know, it's just these stark black images with such minimal lighting, you know? Like, really, really beautiful looking movie.
Money shots in the trailer. I think it's actually the moment when it says from the producer of Terminator 2.
From the producer of Terminator and Aliens, yeah.
See the guy down in the tunnel sweep the light across the screen.
Yeah, and he's got the dog with him, yeah.
And, like, the big lens flare goes off.
Yeah.
And that was just you know, Himes wasn't always – I mean, he is a great visualist. The guy's got a great eye, but he was never somebody who really screamed out to me as to having his trademark. But I look at that shot, and it's instantly mm-hmm. recognized as Peter Himes.
Yeah.
That's the same. I mean, I didn't really think about that until I started rewatching his movies in preparation for this. And, I mean, I'd always kind of, for some reason, I thought of him as sort of like the kind of guy who could sort of recreate some of the cool visuals of better directors, but not as someone who really had his own style. But actually, I mean,
he definitely does, man. He definitely does.
It's true. Yeah.
He always says in interviews he considers himself a photographer first.
Yeah.
Rather than the director. I mean, that's how he started out, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I listened to an interview with him, and I noticed that was an interesting point you make. He mentioned himself as that first and foremost. And I also read a little bit online about how he applied to the ASC. Did anybody else read this story?
I did, yeah.
And he was rejected, he had framed the rejection letter on the wall. So he certainly is a very talented cinematographer.
How many movies does he do the job himself, right?
He did not do Capricorn 1, and
well,
that
he didn't really,
was
he didn't
only
start
one.
Until, like, Running Scared or The Presidio, I think. Maybe 2010.
Oh, he did Outland. He did Outland.
Yeah, he was director of – he was DP on Outland.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, well, Outland is an interesting case because they
somebody
were –
somebody should tell IMDb.
Yeah, they were – well, here's the story behind it. I mean, they were apparently shooting in some sort of format that called IntroVision, which allowed them to optically combine their mats with the live plates. Well, anyway,
is that the shit they used to film Megaforce?
No,
using Power Rangers technology. No, the choice to use and then I'm looking right now. The DP was named Steven Goldblatt, and he was hired by Peter Himes in order to be a scapegoat if the IntroVision didn't work out. And the fellow whom he hired, you know, is a talented DP in his own right, from you know, I guess that's subjective, but the cinematographer wasn't happy, but he stayed on the entire time because according to this story here, because if he cut out on the film, it probably would have ruined his career. Because it was a larger budgeted science fiction film, and he stayed on to learn the system too. So I thought that was really interesting because it definitely looked like a Himes film. You know, it had a lot of the things that he uses. He uses a lot of smoke, like Ridley does. One of the funny things I noticed in Outland was, you know how sometimes the DP will hose down the floor or hose down the city street in order to get the reflection of the bounce of the light and to make it more interesting visually, more busy. They did that in Outland as well. There's like a scene, Sean Connery is walking across a floor that is perfectly wetted down and mirrored. And I was like, isn't this space?
There's a fantastic shot in an otherwise not fantastic movie, in my opinion, that Peter Himes did in The Star Chamber. There's a shot where Michael Douglas is walking across this big room in an abandoned factory, and it's got these pillars, and the floor is just glass water and perfectly reflects the pillars. It's an amazing shot.
I think I know the one you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can picture it in my head.
I'm making the pictures in my brain, and the pictures seem familiar.
You better watch that, man. The Cthulhu's going to come and tear your brain out to eat your hypothalamus.
What's he doing? Starting a hypothalamus collection? That was it.
That's funny. That's funny about Outland too. You know, it's like I'm looking at all the list of all the Himes films, and I mean, almost with the exception of, I guess, the newer one, which I didn't see, the lawyer one with Michael Douglas.
Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I enjoyed that movie.
Yeah.
I thought it was pretty good.
And stay tuned. Had a John Ritter had a wife in that. I forget the actress's name, but I think The Relic's the only one with a female protagonist. Am I wrong?
Penelope Ann Miller.
Yeah.
Hot off of her success in Adventures in Babysitting.
Pee-wee's big top Pee-wee there.
Yeah. But you know what?
He's kind of stuck on that though, man. She was the main character in the book, right?
Yeah, she was. Yeah.
And I think in the movie they significantly bolstered
Sizemore's role. Yeah.
Sizemore's role, the cop.
Yeah.
He's hardly in the book, right?
Yeah, they kind of make it like more of a partnership. Like, and what I love about The Relic as a movie, I love how the two plots run parallel, and like you don't really realize the link between them until the tail end of the film. Like, you know they're going to be connected because it's a horror film, but like the whole thing about the ship from South America full of dead bodies. And then the opening in a museum and how they're connected, like how it all leads together. Like, what the hell does a derelict vessel floating in the Great Lakes have to do with the old... Like,
someone dropping a box and the cockroach from Naked Lunch running across the...
You know, I like how they handle the subplots. I like how they tied it all together. And I mean, I know a lot of that was taken from the book, but I do think they handle it really well in the film. Because, I mean, when I'd seen the movie, I hadn't read the book. I wasn't familiar with the book at all. I know that at the time, it was, you know, the book was considered the next Jurassic Park, you know, the next big Crichton-ish breakthrough kind of book, and I had no interest whatsoever for that reason. But when I saw the movie...
Exposition! Again, not a Jurassic fan.
And when I saw the movie, you know, like, I came away with it, came away from The Relic... with three things. Four things, really. Goddamn, that was dark. Goddamn, that was bloody. Man, Tom Sizemore is a pretty cool leading man. And Jesus, Penelope Ann Miller is really cute.
Yeah. Too bad she dragged Carlito's way down like a rock.
Yeah, she did.
Didn't he have, like, one of his lines at the end of the movie was about her dragging it down like a rock?
I think Brian De Palma walked on and just punched her in the face and then walked out of frame. Oh, I'm looking.
I think that's a perfect place for us to move on to our bed.
I'll say this much: she's no Lorraine Bracco.
Way to set the mood, Andrew. Up a little bit here, Mike. We'll start with you. What's your bad? Do we have to do the reminder again?
Not bad. It's just kind of good, but it's also kind of bad. And we sort of like it, but it's got some flaws. Roll with it.
Let's roll.
Well, thank you for the setup. I would like to say that most of Himes's films fall under that category for me. Even Outland.
Even the good or bad.
Even the good or bad. I mean, Outland.
You guys suck.
No. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you just can't look at Paths of Glory and then look at Outland and tell me that's.
Next week we start the Halloween episode, I'm posting a video on Facebook of me taking a shit on an Argento disc.
See, that's exactly the same thing I would say about Argento. Even the good. Is bad.
Well, I mean, look at it. Look at it this way. In every Himes film, all the bad guys are uniformly terrible shots. You know, I mean, there's gotta be some point in somewhere where the bad guy hits something with a gun, you know?
Well, they do hit something. The wall behind the hero.
Well, see, yeah. A lot of the time too in Himes movies, the bad guys are like these government spook office types. They're not, you know, like black ops operators or something. So most of them are probably working desk jobs.
Well, I'm thinking, I'm thinking of Outland, you know, when those dudes show up, they're hired professional killers.
They're apparently,
what do they
like,
do?
The best killers in the solar system.
What does he do? He brings
Peter Boyle, who I'm pretty sure, you know, qualifies as being mentally retarded.
The guy
is a functioning idiot in the movie. I don't think he'd hire the galaxy's most lethal killers.
Well, the one dude brought like a high velocity, high powered sniper rifle that could puncture the hole at any second of the spaceship.
And then proceeded to camp out and just follow Sean Connery with the scope.
Shotguns I can understand, you know, like, but you know, I mean, after a certain range, okay, I get it. You know, it's not going to penetrate possibly, but you know, whatever space age they were mining titanium, I think in Outland, but, you know, I don't know.
So is Outlander bad?
No, I think all of them are. I mean, cause not,
that's weak, Mark. Pick a movie. Pick a movie.
I'm going to go with Stay
Pick
Tuned.
Pick your least favorite child and stomp on it.
I'm going to pick the child of Stay Tuned. It is the redheaded stepchild in the entire Himes oeuvre or canon or whatever you want to call it. It's the one that stands out the most for me because mostly he's doing I've not seen the early 70s work, but I have seen pretty much everything that he's done in the 80s and the 90s with the exception of the thrillers. I haven't seen The Presidio or Narrow Margin. And it feels to me that he alternates between, I'm sorry if I pronounced that wrong. If he's alternating between the science fiction and the thriller, you know, so I've seen the majority of the science fiction films and Stay Tuned kind of has, it's a film. He's a writer, director slash cinematographer. So he's a man who wears many hats and, you know, Stay Tuned is a film that while he shot it, he and directed it, he did not write it. It's based on somebody else's work. And I think that, you know, it's a pretty high concept film. And by high concept, I mean, pretty simple, thing to describe. You know, they get sucked in the TV. A lot of the humor falls flat on its face, but for some reason, and I like this movie. I have a soft spot for John Ritter. I don't know why. Probably Bad Santa, but
that's probably because he's dead.
Yeah, maybe. And, you know, he was a nice, he seemed like such a nice guy. You know, I wanted him to do well, but that aside, you know, I really enjoyed the concept of the film and probably more than the execution. And it does have its good points. I mean, Jeffrey Jones, again, is chewing up the scenery, just like, I think we talked about in the Tim Burton podcast, his Criswell and Ed Wood. I mean, here again, he delivers like another performance that I think is the best in the film. You know, I think he's underrated as far as his ability to entertain goes. In any case, Eugene Levy pops in for some niceness.
Long enough for me to want to stab him in the face with an ice pick, and then he leaves again.
That's the point. You know,
I hate that man so much.
Oh dear, Steve.
The hatred I hold for Eugene Levy knows no bounds. And that other asshole from SCTV who never amounted to anything, too.
Can't help to tell Beth you hate Jim Stan. She'll never talk to you again.
Well, I mean, I see the scene where Jeffrey Jones transports to the French guillotine scene, you know, the French Revolution scene. His cape. You know, speaking about Tim Burton's, you know, if I can somehow work Batman into this podcast,
oh
I will.
God, no, no.
Jeffrey Jones's cape that he is wearing in the guillotine scene is how Batman's cape should look in every Batman movie. It makes no sense how it lays down perfectly flat and smooth and is draped over, you know, the 30 yards surrounding him, but it looks really cool. You know, and that's a kind of fun little stylistic choice that Himes throws in there. I thought it was a really well shot film, and I remember thinking that too the first time I saw it. It's wow, this is a really well shot film for such a throwaway disposable kind of comedy that's not really funny. But the thing that really, really endears Stay Tuned for me is that it is a 1990s, specifically early 1990s time capsule. It is hilariously bad as far as like, you know, it's fun in the way that certain 80s movies capture the 80s. You know, this has got like the girl, the daughter in the film is totally decked out like Blossom, you know, with her goofy hat and her crazy clashing outfits. The kid is wearing like some kind of lime green neon hat and ride his bike is like a BM. I don't know. It's just to me when I watch it, it's just the 90s, like in a film, you know. Every reference is it's got the what do you call it? Dwayne's Underworld in it. It's got like some pretty It's got some chuckles, no outright laughs, and the Chuck Jones sequence is a lot of fun. You know, the animated sequence, it's always good to see some Chuck Jones in there. And there's the salt and pepper dance off, you know, I mean, with that absurd, I mean,
why are you reminding me of this?
Because I enjoy bad movies, and this movie is bad enough to elevate it to a good status, you know, in my mind's eye. And plus, I'm pretty sure that somebody else here is going to talk about Time Cop, so.
You're leading off with Mike again. Redeem this podcast. What's your bet?
Who?
You.
Yeah, we missed that.
Me? Sorry. My bad.
Redeem this podcast.
I you know what? This movie, I don't even really consider it a bad. I consider it more, you know, it kind of straddles the line between the bad and the good. And I actually really, really enjoyed it. I resisted seeing it for years.
Stop screwing with the format, Steve.
And when I finally did sit down and watch it, I gotta say, I really enjoyed 2010, the year we made contact.
Sure, yeah, that's a good one. I like that one.
I thought it was, you know, it was...
It's not terrible.
No, it's far, really not. It's far from terrible.
And I'm sure you, like everyone else, has been told for years that it's absolute dog shit.
Well, I mean, it's you're following up, you know, the number one acid trip of movie history. You know, you're following up 2001, which is...
The master.
In some people's opinion, yes.
I heard that Kubrick watched it in a theater and smacked his forehead and said, "Of course, Lithgow and Balaban."
Really?
In the movie, did they cut out the synth pop version of Also Sprach Zarathustra?
No, I believe that might have been in there, but I don't think it was synth pop.
It's composed. Actually, they had a composer. I forget.
The police who did it.
Yeah, yes, not Stuart Copeland, somebody else in there.
Yeah.
But,
David Shire? Score,
well, his score was accepted, the other score was rejected, if I'm not mistaken. I believe I read that somewhere, that there was an initial score and that was tossed out.
I'm trying to look that shit up right now.
Initially, Tony Banks, the keyboardist for the band Genesis, was commissioned to
Right.
However, Banks' material was rejected, and David Shire was then selected to compose the soundtrack, which he co-produced along with Craig Huxley.
Andy Summers, guitarist for the band The Police, performed a track entitled 2010, which was a modern new wave pop version of Richard Strauss's Also Sprach Zarathustra.
There you go. There you go.
What the fuck was wrong with the 80s? He also recorded another 2010 bass track entitled To Hell and Back.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, God, I hate The Police
Fantastic.
So much.
Now, the other side of it is the synth pop version of Also Sprach Zarathustra was not used in the film. It did not appear in the movie.
Mm.
But I just, you know, I liked the concept of it. I liked that it picked up where 2001 left off. Like, I mean, I love that whole, you know, that whole Marie Celeste angle, that whole, you know, we found the ship, it's abandoned, you got to go out and find out what's going on, you know, Event Horizon Syndrome or whatever you want to call it, right? But I love that setup. That setup is a great setup for anything. And I really liked how the story evolved. I liked how they kind of worked the monolith into it and stuff like that. I thought it was a pretty effective sequel. And, I mean, you had Kubrick on the original, and I mean, there's no... People can debate Kubrick all they want about whether he was a master or whether he was a little bit hackneyed or whatever, but the one thing you cannot debate about Kubrick is that the man was batshit crazy. That's just... It's a simple fact. And...
Well, and that he was singular.
He was batshit crazy. Let's just call a spade a spade. He was batshit crazy.
Now, here's an important question for you. Helen Mirren's hair... In 2010, were you terrified? her short Sigourney Weaver do.
But no, it's, you know, it's a situation where the sequel, you actually had like the involvement of the original author and stuff like that. Like, it wasn't, you know, the Stanley Kubrick show. It was more of a collaborative movie. It was more of a, you know, you had the author and you had Peter Hyams collaborating on making an effective science fiction film. Rather
it wasn't Jaws.
And Clark, I think Clark actually enjoyed the end product.
He loved it.
It's very. I actually read the book before I saw the movie. It's relatively faithful. There's a couple of things that are different. I think the landing on not Io, was it Europa or Io?
Europa.
That they made a pass and they discovered that there was life under the surface. And initially, I think there was a Chinese astronaut that was destroyed or killed by some kind of space seaweed. As weird as that sounds. And they changed it a little bit. You know, there's a scene in the film where they detect life on that moon. And I like to think
that Outland takes place in the same universe.
It's interesting that I think maybe that's how he got the job, you know, because
yeah, you're good with Jupiter's moons.
Yeah, Io, Europa. Well, I think in the book, I'm not sure if it was Saturn or if it was Jupiter in the book initially. But I mean, Io was the moon in Outland, and Io was the moon in 2010. So you know how Hollywood producers could think
in 2001 and 2010.
Yeah.
And then also you have Capricorn 1 to tie it all in. You know, hey, he's got space experience. Let's put him on this.
But I enjoyed it as a standalone science fiction film. Like, I mean, it doesn't really work without 2001. I mean, 2001 is kind of the setup. But for me, the end of 2001, the final sequence of 2001 is just such artistic, pretentious bullshit. Like, there is no narrative reasoning to have the ending that movie has, whereas with 2010 it's more of a straight ahead science fiction narrative, and that's what I kind of like about it. You know, that like
it definitely.
By the way,
no comment.
All of these worlds are yours except Europa. Attempt no landing there is creepy as fuck.
Yeah, yeah. Use them together. Use them in peace. You know, I thought that was pretty cool. You know,
it's 2010 to me is like the action version of 2001.
It's the more, you know, like it has elements in there that make it clearly identifiable as a sequel to 2001. You know, like it has those elements, but at the same time, it also tries to do things in a more, you know, a more straightforward conventional science fiction narrative. You know, like it tries to be a sci-fi.
More public friendly.
I can't even.
Kind of paradoxical in that it needs 2001 to really work, but it works better
on
a divorced from 2001.
Yeah, yeah. But now it's
what you said in the introduction. If you watch it without considering 2001, it's actually a pretty goddamn effective little sci-fi movie.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess you could watch it without 2001 in the same way that you could sit down and watch something like Event Horizon, you know, and they've got the setup is there, but Event Horizon gives you that exposition, whereas 2010 doesn't, you know? Yeah. This ship disappeared 10 years ago. We need to, you know, like it I mean,
somebody get me Roy Scheider.
Yeah, exactly. You know? But,
imagine Space Mission Captain by Roy Scheider and Lawrence Fishburne.
Oh, man.
Fuck that shit.
It's definitely not as thoughtful or pensive, in my opinion, as the original 2001. And in a way, I felt, even though it's like a 2-hour film or something like that, I felt it's so brisk.
Yeah.
You know, it moved along. I don't know.
I read the setup a little bit, dragged a little bit. I don't know.
Well, the training, it was 2001, it was from where it didn't. I would like to note that it's...
I imagine 2001 Kubrick walking on set the first day, and the first thing he just turns to someone and asks him, by the way, I'm asking for a friend. How long does peyote last?
I'd like to have noted for the record that it is one of those rare 80s training montages that does not have a pop song that goes to it. Well, it has dolphins instead, but...
This is true.
No, they could have had
a pop song. Andy Summers wrote one.
Gonna go to Jupiter, yeah. That's the 80s.
Are you finished up with that, Steve?
I think so.
All right.
I'll say one final thing. And this is like Steve is about to speak hedonism or whatever the hell you want to call it, you know. The warning is out. Steve is about to say something blasphemous. I don't think that 2010 is a better film than 2001, but it's definitely a more enjoyable movie for me.
I am willing to acknowledge that.
It's more of an entertainment. It is
a better entertainment. It is not as good a film.
You don't have to. You don't have to pile a sheet of acid tablets underneath your shirt to.
Oh, hey, everybody, stop what you're doing at home right now. Pause the podcast and look up the video on YouTube of the man who decided it was a good idea to drop acid and go to see 2001 and totally freaks out in the theater. It's a lovely little video of just the man screaming at the screen.
Acid is just such a subjective drug, though. Acid is the king of those drugs that's like, you know, like when you sit down with a bunch of people who've never smoked weed before and they're like, oh man, I'm so high right now. Oh wow. And this is what acid is, the ultimate subjective drug.
I do not
Steve,
have any
probably,
experience.
It's about time we mentioned, actually, this whole series of podcasts was just a pretense for this intervention. We all care about you.
What year is it? I've been quit for how many years now?
That's why the next time that you go to see 2001, we'd prefer that you take mushrooms and not acid.
I'm allergic to mushrooms.
Why don't you tell them how you found out you're allergic to mushrooms?
I don't think that's even story. I don't think that's the story for this kind of company.
Was it pasta?
We're recording this podcast in international waters.
Mom, I hope you're not listening.
I'm here daily now. No, what am I saying? He doesn't listen to us.
Moving on. I'm done.
Forbes.
Whoa, dramatic.
Too bad.
All right, my bad. I am going to go with Capricorn 1. It's pretty solid. You know, it's got a really interesting premise, conspiracy theory.
OJ!
Whoa, someone's yelling OJ.
You know, I think it's interesting because anyone who listened to our last episode about Richard Fleischer, Andrew actually had, you know, a very, very intelligent, entertaining look at the Charlton Heston film Soylent Green. And they're both, you know, that era of sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I'm really intrigued. Go on.
Continue. Yeah. All right. Just raise that bar for me. Thanks. Capricorn 1. Yeah, I mean, it's the premise is, for those who don't know, and by the way, I'm going to spoil the movie, that at the last minute, they've been preparing for this Mars mission, and 2 months before the mission, they discover that one of the key components that they've contracted out for isn't going to work, but for some reason, for the future of the space program, they decide they have to convince people that it's going to go ahead. You would think it would be better just to put it off maybe and manufacture a new component. But anyway, they decide the best way to do this is to not tell the astronauts until they're actually in the space vehicle, then come and get them and take them in a van and then in an airplane out into the desert to...
Threaten your families.
What's that?
Threaten to blow up their families.
Oh, yeah. Well, that comes later. But basically say, like, yeah, this is what happened, and we have to fake this thing sort of in the same way that, you know, there's always been that ridiculous, unfounded theory that the moon landings aren't real. If you believe that, you're dumb. The problem is that they threaten their families if they don't take part, but then they rely on live broadcasts from the set. And you're kind of thinking, well, if you're broadcasting live, if you're one of these astronauts and you don't want your family to be hurt because they don't want anyone to find out, but they're broadcasting across the country live, why can't you just blow the whole thing? I mean, then it's out, and what are they going to do to your family? So, I mean, it sort of hinges on this premise that is pretty flawed.
You got what's his name there the whole time? Himes' regular cameo buddy, King, is that his name? With his finger on the interrupt button the whole time?
Well, he's there with his finger on the interrupt button, but I mean, they seem pretty reluctant to actually hit it unless it's... And they're not even really that... They sort of... You get the sense when they finally do sort of try to get a message out coded. It's been like 8 months or whatever, and they seem pretty relaxed. It's only when they overhear the astronauts talking about how they are going to say something. I mean, even then they don't cut the live broadcast. They just hover with the finger over the button. Before that, they could have said something. So we're subjected to this whole side plot with Elliot Gould, who I really like, but I mean, his part in this movie is pretty stupid, of this reporter who basically runs around trying to find out what's going on because one of his friends who suspected something went missing. And I don't know. I mean, the whole investigation isn't handled very well. It's kind of like he's going on sort of less than just sort of like vague evidence, to go after this whole conspiracy. So it doesn't feel like he's really uncovering anything. And then basically it ends up being that the astronauts go on the run from this desert thing across the desert, and they've got helicopters after them. And then all of a sudden the movie's over and it doesn't really resolve. It's just kind of, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot to like about it. I mean, it's a cool concept. It looks great. The action sequences are really well done. The cast is mostly good, but there are a few too many inconsistencies, a few too many plot holes and logical problems. And then at the end, it's building and you really feel like you need to get some sense of this, you know, not just the characters surviving, but there being some kind of fallout for the people who orchestrated this thing. And there isn't. It's basically just Brolin jumps out of a car with Elliot Gould and they run towards their supposed funeral and smile and then credits.
Yeah, but you know, there's cameras rolling and stuff too.
No, I mean, it's not like you don't know that something's going to happen, but it's just, it's played pretty poorly. And Hal Holbrook, who was, you know, sort of propped up as the big bad in the movie, he sort of looks over and he sees Brolin and he's kind of like, oh, well, shit. You know, like, he looks kind of like he just, you know, remembered that he missed a dentist appointment or something.
There's one thing I love about Capricorn 1, and there's one thing I really, really hate. I love when the astronauts all realize that, you know, we're dead.
Yeah.
You know, when they overhear the whole plot about the thing, the heat shield failure and stuff like that, and it's like, well, shit, yeah, that's it. They're gonna kill us. Yeah. I thought that was really cool, but I hated the old, you know, the tired old cliche, the brakes have been disabled on my car.
Yeah.
That entire action scene just felt like...
Oh, man, and there's so much undercranking in that action
scene. Yeah. That whole scene just felt so hokey, man.
Yeah, undercranking was very distracting.
Think of it, like, in the early and mid-80s, you know, when... Really, most of the film industry had completely gone away from that, or at least had managed to be much more subtle about the way they used undercranking. The Terminator has it, but it's done much better. But yeah, you really notice it. Like
you've got that decade with Bullet. You've got the decade with the French Connection. I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't go drive around fast, other than, you know. I mean, he's doing circles and he's going 90 miles an hour in circles. I mean, the thing about it is that really is distracting is that there's these scenes during the chase where it cuts to Elliot Gould's face, you know, a POV, a shot from the dashboard to Elliot Gould's face that is undercranked, and Elliot Gould's eyebrows and like mouth are going, you know, like, because in order to match the, I mean, he's probably going 30, you know, like, but, you know, in order to match the background, you know, they had to undercrank that. And that's when it really takes me out of it, you know, not so much the POV shots of the bumper, you know, and the road, like you see in the French Connection, you know, but, those shots that they cut to Elliot Gould, it's like, what? Ugh.
For some reason, Elliot Gould in this movie reminds me of my hero and idol, Mr. Jeremy Clarkson. I don't know why. He just does.
My thing about it is, why did it have to be the faulty life support system by a corrupt NASA contractor?
I don't really have a problem with that.
Why couldn't it just be gross incompetence?
I didn't really have a problem with that, though.
Why could it be somebody sitting up and realizing, you know, we just built a machine with millions of moving parts and we went with the lowest bidder?
Well, it's a theme that pops up again in his work. I mean, he clearly is an axe to grind in Outland.
Kia should not have designed her.
Hey, don't diss Kia.
This doesn't say NASA. It says Casio.
Yes, we can diss Casio.
Sorny.
Magnet box.
There are a couple of flaws I want to talk about in the movie. I mean, one of them, Hal Holbrook is a really good actor. Right?
Sure.
Most people are going to agree.
His speech is you could draw parallels between his speech and what is that actor from Network? He was Gene Hackman's sidekick in Superman.
Ned Beatty.
He's got there's a certain speech that Holbrook gives in the beginning of the film. It's almost expository, but
That's the thing. I know Hal Holbrook in this and in the Star Chamber, he's, you know, even when he doesn't have great material, he sells it like really well. But the problem in this movie, I didn't really buy his character. I mean, your setup is that, you know, he's lifelong friends or like decades long friends with our main character.
As evidenced by pictures on the wall.
Yeah. He knows the family. I mean, they basically are a family. He's a scientist. He's dedicated his life to this thing, but then
he calls him Brew. I mean, they're on like, hey, Brew, instead of Brew Baker.
And then, you know, the lengths he goes to protect this conspiracy, I just don't buy it. He seems like the kind of guy, if he is the person that they're saying he is, that he would sacrifice himself before he actually, you know, went through with this thing. Apparently he's just an evil bastard.
The biggest problem I have with it, like the biggest real glaring omission for me, is why he feels so driven to fake it. Like, why it has to happen, you know?
Well,
like,
maybe he's got some, you know, some pressure.
They can't let those godless communists get a leg up.
Wolverines!
Sorry. The thing is, like, in this movie, you know, he's apparently, like, he's all about the science.
Yeah.
He's a scientist. When, you know, that's what was driving him his whole life, but then he goes to these lengths for the economics of it.
Yeah.
Well, maybe he's got some unseen political pressure placed on him. Maybe somebody's threatening his grandkids or something like
that. That was the big theory I saw kicked around, was that it was, you know, like he had pressure from elsewhere on him. But it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. Like, did a bunch of black suited guys sitting in like a room in the White House pick up a phone and say, this mission has to happen, you know, or everyone you know or care about is dead?
Well, I think this discussion is emblematic of the whole of Peter Hyams' career, is that his movies are not to be, they're not like, they don't stand scrutiny, especially when you take a look at the logic and the science. Capricorn 1 is a really good thriller. It's got a great performance by Sam Waterston. Is that his name, Waterston? Yep. He just cracks me up in this movie. He does so much with his character. OJ basically just sits there and has like three lines of dialogue and shoots a flare up in the air. You got Telly Savalas, who's just like the biggest thing in the picture. Yeah. His performance is hilariously absurdly large.
It would have been fine. I would have been fine with it. That performance was dropped into a serious conspiracy thriller where people were running for their lives and to save their families.
Yeah, it just says the Benny Hill music pops on it.
Exactly.
You have so many good things about it, though, that work, you know? I mean, as long as you're – and I read some quote. I think it was on Internet Movie Database, and so I'm not sure how reliable it is. But not that I'm questioning Internet Movie Databases, perhaps, by no means. But you know, Hyams has criticized his own pictures, and he feels that you know, when he looks back on them, he just cringes at some, you know, I mean, cause especially when you compare yourself to the obsessive and obsessed to detail, meticulous Stanley Kubrick with 2001 compared to 2010, which just breezes by, far more entertaining, but, you know, does not hold up to, even with Arthur C. Clarke getting his back with the science, you know.
Even with Roy Scheider's tan.
Yeah. That movie could have really benefited from a shark in space.
Space shark. Guys.
Space
let's start
shark.
A Kickstarter.
Write it right now.
But I think Capricorn 1 is a film that works on a gut level. It's very entertaining. You totally want to find out what happens. When you go back and think about it, it falls apart.
Hey, John, in space, you can hear a shark roar.
Nice. I think that's the perfect way for me to segue into my bad. Now, you guys should be proud of me for this because I've been living a lie since 1998.
Uh-oh.
I had convinced myself that this was not only a good movie, but an awesome movie.
No, I know where you're going with this.
And I last week when I went up to Halifax, I took it with me to watch on the plane because I was like, any
See,
excuse.
When you said you've been living a lie, I figured it was going to end with Beth heartbroken and your local Walmart selling out of spandex.
No.
You're wrong.
Just no.
Sorry, continue. Sorry.
You are wrong, Leonidas. So I sat down. I took it on the plane with me. I sat down to watch it. And I'm not going to say it's downright terrible, but it still holds a special place in my heart, so I can't call it my ugly. But the movie is so deeply and fundamentally flawed, I'm just going to rant for a little while on it. And that's 1986 is Running Scared. I think somewhere in there, like, I love a good buddy cop movie. I love a good 80s action movie. And the whole concept of, you know, two guys on the short list for retirement trying to bring down that kind of their list before they call it quits is, you know, that there could be a good story there. But this movie seems intent on, like, squeezing a franchise's worth of stories into one movie, and it can't fucking decide what it wants to be about.
You know, I hear buddy action, I think Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. There's your first problem right there. You cast a ballet dancer and Fernando from SNL. He was fresh off Fernando because he does the fucking Fernando voice in the movie. Right? And it's just there are moments in it where it's just like amazingly Billy Crystal managed to sell himself as a badass. Exactly five seconds later, he flushes that fucking goodwill straight down the shitter, opening his mouth and reminding you that he's Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
Just, we cannot decide what it wants to be about. You know, you've got so many subplots. You've got the Billy Crystal's ex-wife is getting married again. Billy Crystal's aunt just left and died and left him $1,000. You know, the guys are retiring and buying a bar. Oh, no, now look, they're training two rookie officers to take over for them when they leave. Dan Hedaya is the asshole, stupid chief who appears to have multiple personality disorder because one minute he's telling them that, you know, he doesn't want them to be the wild men of the department anymore. Now he wants to train two more wild men. So, you know, you guys should operate with a little more courtesy. Hey, don't you be careful when you're out on the streets because being careful gets you killed in this line of work. And Jimmy Smits is the least threatening drug lord in history. It's fucking terrible. All of these little things in the movie, you know, the end of it is this beautifully shot gunfight in the, I think it's called the State Building, basically this giant glass dome in Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah, where Gregory Hines is trying to get up to the upper floor to get the drop on the guys, and it's like, is there any way up there? Is there a ladder? Is there a service elevator? And everyone's like, just the window washer's rig. And he looks over at the window washer's rig piled on the floor, just a pile of rope and everything. And then the next scene is him climbing the side of the building with it. How the fuck did he get it hooked to the roof? It's just, the movie is barely over an hour and a half long. It's about an hour and 45 minutes, and it suffers from Bad Boys 2 syndrome. It's just, it's bloated to the point that it feels like it's 3 hours long. There's that much going on in the story that doesn't go anywhere.
I just really friggin' hate Billy Crystal.
He's terrible.
Likewise.
Oh my God, I hate him. And I mean, like,
and I mean, there's the one moment in the movie where he does the he pulls the whole no hablé anglais, and he does
the phone.
You know, you have the right to remain. You have the right to a coroner. If you cannot afford one, the state will appoint a medical examiner for you. And then 3 seconds later, he says something stupid and goofy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's just. Really, you know, when you compare it to stuff like 48 Hours and Lethal Weapon, the movie just might as well not exist.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those movies that, like, you know, you have fond memories of it, and you
kind of the state building, the car chase on the L track, right?
Yeah,
there's some good, and Haim shoots the shit out of it. Just who the fuck cast Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal as cops?
My biggest problem with it, I think the biggest problem I have with the movie, it's Billy Crystal related. I mean, for one, it's Billy Crystal, and two, he's dressed in that fucking obnoxiously garish Chicago Cubs shit for the entire movie. It'd be the equivalent of filming like an uber gritty cop film in downtown Toronto and sticking Colm Feore in a Montreal Canadiens jersey for the entire runtime. You know, it's just fucking stupid.
He switched it out for the Mets cap and City Slickers.
Yeah, it's just like, oh my God, really? Like,
you got the guy wearing a there's one scene he's got a Cubs jersey on, there's one scene he's got a Blackhawks jersey on. I'm pretty sure there's a White Sox jersey in there somewhere.
Well, you got Peter Himes is from Chicago, right? This is, I feel like he took this movie coming off of the success of 2010, which was, I think, what it cost? It made money. It didn't lose money.
The budget. He managed to. He brought in $50 million on a $25 million budget, yeah. Right?
And I'm not sure about his other films, particularly The Star Chamber. I don't know what city that takes place in.
Star Chamber, Washington, I thought, wasn't it?
Washington. Okay. A Sound of Thunder is Chicago.
Chimes is from New York.
Is he from New York? Yeah. Syracuse, right? But wasn't he I believe I read in some Ebert
review somewhere.
Yeah,
another conspiracy plot hole.
Well, I remember that he was a TV news anchor in Chicago because I read that in an Ebert review. And I think of Running Scared. And
everything conspiracy. This is why Siskel and Ebert always reviewed his movies so well.
Did they?
Yeah, they love his shit.
Oh. Ebert drools over anything in Chicago.
They gave The Relic 2 thumbs up. I'm pretty sure Ebert gave Running Scared 3 out of 4 stars.
Yeah, well, I know 2010 did. They ranked that really well. So this is what it is. Chicago boy does good, see?
And I mean,
that's why he always reviews Andrew Davis so well, too.
like Steve, you were talking about, you know, there's some good memories in there. I mean, there is. Like, I love the bit with the coming out and seeing all the punk kids spraying unmarked police car on the side of their vehicle.
Yeah.
Stuff like that is good. Like, buried somewhere under all the, what did you call it, Andrew? Casting diarrhea. and Running Scared is horrible. You know, Darrell Ann Flugel. Am I pronouncing it properly? The charisma vacuum.
Who cares? Whether you're pronouncing it right or not. If it's wrong, her attorneys will contact us, I'm sure.
It hits all of the tropes for the buddy comedy. I mean, it has the pop song with the saxophone in it, like right off the bat. You know, that kind of that 19, I think every movie, I think, was contractually obligated to have a pop song with
every,
a sax.
Every movie from 86, even Aliens, which just seemed odd. The sax just...
Well, that's all they listened to in their cryotubes was Kenny G. They just pumped that shit right in there. That's the fastest way to keep
somebody... I'd love to see Ripley turning to one of the eggs with a clarinet. And the queen just going, oh.
Sorry.
It was produced by David Foster. That explains the saxophone.
There you go. Oh, David Foster.
So, yeah, there you go. You know, Running Scared. There's parts of it I like, but there's so much to hate.
It's well shot, though. It's really well shot.
Speaking of hatred.
Well shot. And, oh, and by the way, you know, I always talk about action movies missing squibs. Not when Jimmy Smits gets shot up at the end of this movie. Holy shit, how much blood came out of him at the end of it.
Himes does that right.
Like, he falls down the escalator, and he looks like one of the guys you just took out with a shotgun in Doom. I'm pretty sure I saw ribs sticking out of his body.
Paul Verhoeven saw that, and he said, I'm going to make a whole movie about, based around this concept. It's going to be called Total Recall.
That in his thick Italian accent.
Well... It's not the
accent. I'm all of the shit.
It's not the accent. It's the enthusiasm.
You want
that man? If Dan Mancini's listening, that's a man that. If Dan Mancini's listening, that's a man who puts exclamations on the end of every sentence. There.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Paul Verhoeven.
And we will get to Paul Verhoeven. Oh yes.
Please invite me. Please invite me for that one.
I was thinking that. The brain bug, it would be something between an anus and a vagina. One of the most amazing parts of any making of documentary. God. It's something you can't unhear.
Does he actually pronounce the I in anus? Anus.
Anyway.
Yeah, let's move on to speaking of anuses.
Meanwhile, Laura's in the other room hearing the context-free comments, probably wondering what the hell is going on.
You're gonna hang up after this is over. She's like, what the hell were you talking about?
No, he's going to hang up, and he's just going to be like, Andrew, I'm divorced.
I don't know. My Coroplast Van Damme is enjoying your puns.
Oh, that's a perfect segue to the ugly. Van Damme. Let's go. Let's go. Okay, who went first last time?
I think I did.
I did with Stay Tuned.
Was that your bad? Yeah, it was. Okay.
That was my bad.
And
yeah.
I say, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was my good. That was my great Stay Tuned.
So you did go.
Hey, I'm going to just jump in here.
What's your ugly?
End of Days.
Oh.
There we go.
Did you say all?
Oh.
This movie should have no defenders. Okay, aww. One of the classic descriptions of Arnold Schwarzenegger, I can't properly cite it because I can't recall who said it, but someone once described him as a brown condom full of walnuts. Now, if you watch End of Days, you will believe that a brown condom full of walnuts can cry. It is, oddly enough, one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's better performances. However... everything else about this movie is awful.
I thought my wife and daughter should have lived. Agreed.
Where to start? Okay, so I'll do a bit of a synopsis. End of Days is about a strung-out ex-cop. Now he's security. His family was killed because he had to testify against some crime lord. Then, for some reason, because of some ancient prophecy, Satan, at this particular time, can come back, and once every 1,000 years, he can have sex with Robin Tunney, and I don't know if the Antichrist emerges, or if it just gives him superpowers, but anyway. So, Satan is spawned. As a sort of pseudo-invisible dragon pterodactyl thing.
That looks really horrible and like something out of Spawn. Really,
sneaks into the men's room and takes over Gabriel Byrne. Now we know Gabriel Byrne he's Satan. Walks out of the men's room, immediately starts making out with the wife of his friend who he was having dinner with, and then heads on out because Satan, he's so evil, he just loves having sex with ladies. That's mostly
how Dude, you remember when he looks at Udo Kier's wife?
Yeah.
And then
also smoking. Smoking and making out with the ladies. That's how you know he's evil. It's hard to sort of summarize the plot because it makes absolutely no sense. Arnold Schwarzenegger's, along with Kevin Pollak, the, you know, high-tech security guy that you would expect, they are protecting a Wall Street banker who it turns out is Gabriel Byrne, because I guess he's heard through the grapevine that someone's going to try to kill him. This part's really poorly explained. This is after Gabriel Byrne is Satan. Arnold Schwarzenegger's shot, but fortunately he's wearing the bulletproof vest, so Satan's okay. They go off on a helicopter chase going after this gunman who is up on a building. Turns out the gunman is a priest named, and this is our first in End of Days horrible names list.
Oh, we got some great names in this movie.
Aquinas. They actually call a priest Thomas Aquinas. That's what passes for, like, depth and symbolism in this.
Was he also played by Piter from Lethal Weapon 2?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
I think we have a double standard here because in Outland, the doctor's name was Dr. Lazarus. So just wanted to point that out there.
Yeah, but that's like super villain sounding, Dr. Lazarus. I'm pretty sure Batman has punched a Dr. Lazarus in the face before.
Speaking of punched in the face, Udo Kier gets a fistful of burn. And that is why this movie is not ugly to me. That scene is just, I love it so much. It was just such a beautiful Bob Gunn bam scene for this film. Just out of nowhere, Gabriel Byrne just punches a hole in his head. And I love that. Sorry, I defer.
Okay, let's – no, come on. I want him to get to another name.
All right. Arnold Schwarzenegger.
There's even worse than Schwarzenegger, though. Kevin Pollak's name is fucking amazing.
Wait, all right. Arnold Schwarzenegger's character. You know, we're dealing with big themes like Satan and evil and, you know, loss of family and all of that. So, of course, Jericho Kane.
The most Germanic of names.
And
that's
like
the John Matrix. That's fucking
No, it's not.
See, I mean, the difference is John Matrix is awesome.
Ever again. No Kane. Kane is out. You're never allowed to name another character Kane. Every single character in every movie ever made is named Kane.
Unless it's K-A-N-E. That's okay.
Michael Kane has to change his name.
Kane Hodder has to change his name.
Oh, whatever. I don't care about that guy. He's not a real actor.
Solomon Kane was fucking awesome.
Moving up the name list.
Solomon Kane.
Like, because he's
awesome.
Sort of wisecracking comic. His name is Bobby Chicago.
Bobby Chicago.
Siskel and Ebert. Two thumbs up.
Now,
isn't there a Dr. Abel in this movie, too?
I missed that, John.
I said, isn't there a Dr. Abel in this movie?
No, but there is a Lenny Albuquerque, I think, floating around in the background. Extra.
But all of these, believe it or not, pale in comparison to the worst name in the movie because it doubles as a plot point. Here is a child who was born, prophesied to either fulfill Satan's little, you know, prophecy thing or not. They're deciphering something. Oh, it's Christ in New York. Oh, it's not Christ in New York. It's Christy in York.
Whose asshole just coughed?
I think that was all of ours.
Okay, Steve, you remember when you made the sad noise at the beginning?
Yeah.
Do you take that back?
No.
This is writing on the level of the three. This is like technology versus horse.
You know what really, really rots my crap about this movie?
What's that?
That Arnold Schwarzenegger got paid $25 million for it.
No, that they totally rip off the gearing up scene from Commando in it. They blatantly rip it off in the tail end of the movie.
It doesn't have the awesome Moog synthesizer.
Well, no, it feels like 10 minutes of Arnold Schwarzenegger loading and cocking machine guns and slotting knives into sheaths. You know,
after Rod Steiger has already told him he can't shoot the devil,
he's just like, gotta go kill Satan
with a grenade launcher, because that's how you do it.
And I mean, okay, on top of all of this.
We mentioned how terrible Rod Steiger is in it, because he's pretty terrible.
There. Rod Steiger will have his moment in the spotlight. Let's talk about Rod Steiger right now. Rod Steiger plays, who I think what this movie, in the universe of this movie, his character is what passes for profound and nuanced philosophical discourse, which basically translates into,
like, so the Telly Savalas of End of Days.
It's awful. He basically just...
Let's look at this wisdom. The number of the beast, but numbers can be perceived differently. So instead of 666, it's 999.
Oh my god, it's like the Uno ever. We've got the... On top of all this, we've got the hoary old cliches like... The man who lost his faith because his family was taken away, and so he hates God. Just piles upon piles of ham-fisted religious symbology. I don't even want to count how many people get crucified in this movie. We've got Satan, who can either be, you know, not killed by weapons, you know, when it's needed, or he needs an entire security detail to protect him against one gun. He can heal wounds, but then he can't heal wounds. He can take over bodies, but he doesn't bother to take over bodies of those who would be more effective. He doesn't bother to kill his main opponent. He goes monologuing like crazy. He's got superhuman strength, unless you have to just pull him out of a window, then he's just a normal guy. let's see. He can't see into churches, but he can walk into churches.
And apparently he can turn into a big giant Todd McFarlane-drawn Satan demon thing inside a church.
Yeah. By way of, I don't know, the reptile from the Mortal Kombat movie. The entire
reptile looked better.
Is edited horribly. It's basically a huge anti-climax, and it ends with, spoiler alert, Arnold Schwarzenegger, instead of just, you know, not, he decides he's going to throw himself on a sword, which he didn't have to do because basically in 5 seconds, the whole prophecy couldn't be fulfilled. And it's not like it could have been within that time period. So he just kills himself for no reason. But it does give us an excuse to see his family in some fluffy clouds. Just everything about this movie is terrible. Oh, and just in case, you know, that wasn't bad enough, we get to have a crazy albino just because albinos are scary, right?
They scare me.
An albino with some crazy-ass cornrows.
Yeah. I mean, he's an excuse for a special effect. But yeah, Satan can bring people back to life, but apparently... only one character because it's important, except it isn't really that important. So everything about this is awful. You take that noise back, Steve Power. You take it back now.
I was only making it because you didn't pick the one I was thinking about picking.
All right.
It's not so much that End of Days is a good movie. It's just that I think this one is worse.
End of Days also has the privilege of being the last Laserdisc ever pressed. So it's also end of format.
End of Laserdisc days.
I think we should go now with Steve. I'm really intrigued on what your ugly is.
You're not going to be happy with me, but I don't really give a shit. When have I ever cared?
Yeah.
I know you're not going to be happy. Andrew's probably not going to be happy. I doubt Mike is going to be happy. And I know Dan and Dave.
Probably picked the same ugly as me, actually.
My ugly is the cinematic steaming pile of rip-off shit known as Sudden Death.
Oh, no.
Sudden Death is a piece of crap. That movie
okay,
is...
Just a second. Before you go any further, we're going to double team the shit out of this.
Okay.
We're going to bridge fuck Sudden Death. That's what I'm
You know,
Steve, I still want that widescreen copy.
Oh, I have it, and I'll put it in the Dropbox for you if you want it.
Come on, this movie's got Powers Booth in it.
It still sucks.
Come on.
Okay, listen. That movie would have to have 8 Powers Booth in it to make up for the shitstorm that is Dorian Harewood.
Powers Booth.
But when I was 13, he got all burned and jumped out, and it was really scary, and I was like, nah!
The helicopter flying like backwards into the top of the open arena, and
I don't care if the building is falling down around you. You don't move.
Van Damme giving one of his
typical New York firefighter.
Van Damme giving one of his worst performances of his career, and that's really saying something.
His name is Darren McCord.
He couldn't be any less Scottish.
Awesomeness of Van Damme stabbing Bob Dylan in the throat with a turkey bone.
That was bad, too. That was just stupid. It was just...
This is my big problem with Sudden Death. I saw Sudden Death in theaters. My sister and my cousin were going to see Toy Story. My father and I wanted to go see Heat in theaters.
Yep. Toy Story. Oh, wow, you lost out. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, Toy Story is 80 minutes long. Heat is 3 hours long. So we chose something a little similar in length to Toy Story and went with Sudden Death, as both of us had already seen GoldenEye.
Yeah.
At the time,
that was a great year.
It was.
I loved all the. I love when movies come up with diehard deaths, like Bruce Willis stabbing a guy in the eye with an icicle.
But
Sudden Death, it's just they're so. I don't know. The entire movie existed for an excuse for a guy to have a skate press jammed through his hand.
There's nothing wrong with that.
There's lots wrong with that. The fact that it was all filmed in like the fucking Pittsburgh Penguin Stadium during Stanley Cup playoffs time, and Van Damme jumps in net and saves the Pens from losing the cup. Seriously?
That's how it really happened.
Seriously?
Don't you remember, man?
Come on.
It's the best series ever.
Well, I knew Tom Barrasso sucked, but I didn't think Van Damme was any better.
I thought they were scared of pissing off Pittsburgh, so they made up a goalie instead of Tommy Barrasso.
I think they did actually. Yeah, I don't think it was actually Tom Barrasso, but they used his.
Believe the movie actually had Luke Robitaille in it, though.
It was just, man. It was
just for an excuse to have him and Van Damme speak French to one another.
And every
He'd tell us how they weren't speaking the same French.
And every freaking scene in the movie that was like an exposition scene or like, a character scene, anything that wasn't an action scene just felt so goddamn flat and lifeless and scripted. Like, it just felt so stage production. Like, it was goddamn horrible. It made Under Siege look like Citizen Kane.
This is another sad point. Okay,
or Under Siege, too.
It made Under Siege 2 look like Under Siege.
I'm not the biggest Time Cop fan in the world, but Time Cop was at least a passable action movie. The fact that this followed up Third Target, which was made a big fucking superstar.
I thought Time Cop followed up Third Target.
Yeah, no, but you had Van Damme. He had that one period, after he came out Double Impact and Death Warrant.
Yeah.
You had, like, Universal Soldier, which was awesome, and Hard Target, which was awesome, right?
Yeah.
And, the guy actually, he stepped out of the Pretenders area with Chuck Norris and all the other guys and actually became a bankable action star, right? And you had Sudden Death, and after that it was like, Maximum and direct to video. Right?
Yeah, the thing with Sudden Death too is I remember Sudden Death was probably the most hyped Van Damme movie I can recall. Like,
I can remember the commercials for Terror Goes Into Overtime.
Yeah.
I had the weirdest boner in
1990. But I think it was like after Hard Target and Time Cop, which were both pretty big hits, all of a sudden Van Damme was, you know, he was
instead of being another Chuck Norris, this was a guy whose name could bring in $100 million.
Yeah, he had become, you know, like there was talk. I remember seeing an article. I think it might have been in Rolling Stone magazine or one of the movie magazines about how, you know, Van Damme was going to be the heir apparent to the throne left vacant by Schwarzenegger and Stallone. You know, like this kind of stuff. Yeah. You know.
I can confirm that. I remember I was 13 years old and I saw Time Cop at the drive-in movie theater and a double bill with Terminal Velocity with your old buddy Ditch Brody there. And
Natasha Kinney is hot as rock.
And Tony Soprano, and he totally was at the height of his powers back in Time Cop. I was so pumped to see Time Cop that I was a little disappointed that Terminal Velocity was the more entertaining of the two.
Just Time Cop. Nobody here badmouths Maximum Risk.
I am still kicking. I must be in the ballet.
See, my whole thing too with Sudden Death is like, okay, I'm not a lover of Time Cop. I never was. I wasn't a big Van Damme guy. I didn't really follow Van Damme. Like when Hard Target came out, I was more interested in it because it was, you know, the first American film by international superstar John Woo. You know, this is why I wanted to see Hard Target. And, you know, I loved Hard Target. I thought Hard Target was amazing.
Prior to Hard Target, could you get stuff like Hard Boiled in North America?
Yes, you could, yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, I was desperate to see Hard Target, and I thought, hey, maybe there's something to this Van Damme guy after all. Then I saw Time Cop in theater opening weekend, which was boring as shit. Like, I mean, I would have picked Time Cop as my ugly, only for Sudden Death is just so much of a shit sandwich over Time Cop. Nothing happens in Time Cop, you know? Every set in Time Cop is just Van Damme and whoever he happens to be acting against. There's
but
no
Van Damme one. Spends most of that movie walking through the special effects from Tech War.
Okay, listen. Has anyone on this podcast ever actually been to Chicago?
No.
Or Washington or any major American city?
No.
I've been to Chicago.
Okay, I'm assuming that on the streets of Chicago, you know, you're talking about people numbering in the thousands, right, at any given time.
Yeah, it's a city. It's a big city.
It's a bustling metropolis, right?
In a Peter Hyams movie, all the streets are empty.
Why the fuck in Time Cop is Van Damme the only person breathing air?
There are no extras in these movies. In Time Cop.
Oh yeah, sure. They're in Time Cop when they're falling out the building. There's all these 1930s extras. They got to clear out the way, like in the Hudsucker Proxy. When
I'm pretty sure most of the movie was shot in like Shawinigan.
Shawinigan.
Handshake,
see, the mall at the beginning is a prime example. They're at a crowded shopping mall. Crowded consists of Van Damme, his girlfriend, and the dude who steals her purse.
And his mullet.
we must.
No, no. Young Van Damme doesn't have a mullet. Old Van Damme has the mullet.
Yeah. Oh, that's so, how you tell him
apart. But
there's
two Van Dammes. There's Van Damme with the mullet, Van Damme without. So they're both there. So really, you got to double the Van Damme when considering that crowd.
Anyway, Sudden Death was worse. Sudden Death was even more horrible.
You're in a crowded hockey arena. And listen, I've been in a hockey arena. Even when the game is going on, there's more than one person in the hallways.
It was just, like...
The game was that good, though. Come on.
Like, every scene is just, you know, like, again. You know, they walk into the dressing room at the beginning, you know, when they're bringing the vice president around, and, you know, he's like, have a good game, fellas, and win the championship or whatever, and then, you know, the guys are like, will you say the same thing to the Blackhawks, sir? You bet I will. And, like, it's all so fucking fake. It's all so, like, forced deliveries, you know? It feels like they got a bunch of people who weren't actors to be.
Yeah, but, you know, it's got all the Peter Hyams staples. You know, it's got a kitchen fight, you know?
It's a horrible kitchen fight, though.
Well, is it worse than the kitchen fight in Outland with, like, the deep fryer?
Oh, yeah. You know? Hell yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing about that kitchen fight is that her mascot suit is able to protect her from a man who can, you know, kick a person's head off their shoulders.
Yeah, there's also that.
Yeah. You know, you've got a normal girl in a mascot suit, you know, fighting against the living, breathing incarnation of Mortal Kombat.
You've got the man with the 75-mile-an-hour roundhouse kick.
Yeah.
You know.
And he can't knock her the fuck out with that.
It's a horrible movie. Moving on. Who's next?
Mike Rubino's sitting at home pulling his hair out right now.
only Michael's left because Sudden Death is on my bed.
Oh, okay.
My ugly.
Come on, I just want to say, have you guys, as kids, walked into an arena, stared at that scaffolding in the ceiling, and just fantasized about crawling around up there?
Yeah.
I'm terrified of heights, so no.
Oh, I used to...
We didn't have a stadium that big until we were both, like, out of high school.
I used to see the Devils, and man, that I always just fantasized about that. And then seeing
stadium
and then
I grew up going to is now a supermarket, and you just made me cry.
We should move on now.
We should. We really should.
I am shocked. Fuck Power Booth. I just want to say that I am shocked and very surprised. That nobody here. I'm assuming, John, that both yours and Steve's bad was Sudden Death. You definitely double team that, like Van Damme team Double Impact.
Yep. Evil twins.
I am shocked that none of you have mentioned at all A Sound of Thunder.
That was my original choice, actually, because that was a goddamn terrible movie too.
But that's the other thing. I didn't watch A Sound of Thunder because
you couldn't watch it, right? It was just, I mean, to me, I almost put that as my good because it was so bad that it was good.
No, it wasn't. It was just horrible.
Oh, no. Let me point all the ways out to, okay, first I should preface it by saying that this movie is one of the more recent Himes films. It's 2005, I believe, although I think it was shot in 2002. I'm not sure.
2002
in Prague.
Yeah, it was shelved for a while.
Yeah, there was some major production problems. The company that financed it went bankrupt. And it was a larger budgeted film. It was like a $40 or $50 million film. And, you know, I suppose it was rescued from the shelf. I don't know how.
I don't know why.
Yeah, exactly. But this film features some of the most laughable special effects since Plan 9. I mean, is especially in the age of CG, it is just, and I, for the life of me, I can't understand why Himes didn't take a Smythe credit, you know, or you know, what is that name, the Alan Smith or Alan
Smithy?
Alan Smithy, yeah, like credit, you know. I guess, I mean, it is just a glare. I mean, say what you will about Sudden Death or Time Cop or any of these other movies, those are coherent films that at least have some. This movie is got to be seen to be believed.
Don't see it. It causes it wreaks
see
havoc
it.
On the weak minded.
See it. I am not sure if there's a Riff Trax out. I'm not sure if there's a Riff Trax available where, you know. I mean, that would certainly help the viewing experience, but. I mean, you have some absurdly poor special effects, and you have Ben Kingsley's hair, which is, just look it up. It is just beautiful.
This is a movie that Rennie Harlan was fired from.
Yes.
As somebody who has never seen it, is it actually based on the Ray Bradbury story?
It is, and that's actually why Harlan was fired. He deviated from something that Bradbury had suggested. And the studio basically sided with Bradbury.
Oh, yeah. I read that.
He wanted to have someone stabbed in the eye with an icicle.
No, I think he wanted to change the story because he started filming and thought, man, this is a really shitty movie.
Well, I support the concept. I think that's a pretty interesting concept, and it could have been done well. I would have liked to have seen what they did with the city of Chicago because the futurist vision of it, you know, you could certainly tell it was ambitious with, you know, I mean, maybe he was going for a Minority Report kind of feel or vibe. I'm not sure how that came across, but they just did not have any budget to finish the effects. And unfortunately, they
How could they? They blew it all on massive star Edward Burns.
Hot off Saving Private Ryan 10 years previous.
I like Ed Burns. I can't say that I don't like him, but...
But you don't cast him to carry your multi-million dollar
sci-fi
action movie.
That's very true. You know, I mean, just as a leading man, his voice is... And his voice is a little high for a leading man. And,
also, he's a walking smirk.
I have to say that, you know, just the amount of enjoyment that I got out of this film for the absurdity, I say it before, but I really enjoy bad films, and this is a particularly enjoyable bad film, full with every cliche that you can think of, with all of the awful effects. I mean, that Shark Attack 3 had better effects than this. Birdemic is on par, I think. Well, no, that's not. I shouldn't say
now
that.
Now you're being mean. Now you're being mean.
One day we're actually gonna get a movie that gets Michael angry enough to the point that he,
he
doesn't see any good in it.
Movies that are mediocre get me upset. You know, movies that miss their potential or, you know, are just boring. I mean, at least this movie has got some kitsch value, some entertainment value. It's fun to make fun of it, you know. And if you've seen, we all have seen a lot of movies. And my theory is that when you get to a certain point, and if you're of a certain disposition, you know, you've seen all these movies, the most enjoyable and the most entertaining films are not the straight comedies. I mean, there's only one Monty Python and the Holy Grail and only one Life of Brian. You know, comedies are not, I don't know, I don't get enjoyment out of most Hollywood comedies.
Because they suck.
Yeah, they really do.
Take that, Hollyweird.
Yeah, the hardest I laugh when I see something is like Space Mutiny or... You know, or the great Canadian film, The Final Sacrifice, if you gentlemen are familiar.
I am.
And I think that a sound of a turd dropping really fits in there with the rest of, the Mystery Science Theater canon. It is very much so bad it's good. And I enjoyed it, I have to say, even though that movie is just, again, with the lapse in logic, you know. I mean,
the time waves. What the hell was up with the time waves?
Well, they got
it was just so goddamn stupid.
Yeah, just don't think about it, you know. Don't think hard about it. Well, actually, it's like what I was saying before. Any Himes film, you just can't think about it too hard.
What the hell happened with the chickie? Like, before they send him back the last time, what was that all about?
Oh, she turned into like a fish. That's how
she
evolution
turned into
works.
A motherfucking catfish. I was like, what the
I'm
hell?
I'm going to buy this movie tomorrow.
No, you're not.
Is this out on Blu-ray?
Is it?
In any way, shape, or form, whether on a self-conscious level or unconscious level, recommend watching this movie under any...
Can you picture me tomorrow at Best Buy, Resident Evil 6 in one hand, and A Sound of Thunder in the other going, eh?
You may want to pass on Resident Evil 6 there, Mr. Mercer.
It is genuinely entertaining in its awfulness, and I really, really like it. I did not think that I would be saying this as I was watching it. I was having, you know, and I had to watch it by myself because nobody in their right mind would watch this film.
It gives me pain in my frontal lobe just thinking about it. I need to go take some aspirin and lie down.
It is just a misfire from the first concept of trying to create a futuristic Chicago and just pretty much every car on every vehicle on the street is a carbon copy of the same yellow taxi cab. They have one model and they reproduced it and the blue screen work is hilarious. I mean, it is. And again, Ben, I mean, there's some interesting performances too. I mean, Ben Kingsley, you know, I mean,
Ben Kingsley was only ever good in one movie.
In a Sound of Thunder, right?
No, absolutely not. No. I can't even pretend to go along on this one.
He's been good in a few.
He's been good. He's been good in. He slums all the time.
I'll give him two. I'll give him two. He was good in Gandhi, and he was good in Prince of Persia. I mean, wait, what?
Sexy Beast.
That would actually be my other choice.
Kingsley was the bomb in Sexy Beast.
Sexy Beast was awesome.
Hugo, he was Melies. So
he was really good.
Oh, yeah.
I was not a fan of Hugo.
He's just a paycheck player sometimes, you know?
He was good in it.
In a fair and just world, Ben Kingsley would get the same level of respect as someone like Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah, for sure.
And where's Malcolm McDowell's fucking Oscar?
Wasn't
he left? I'd like to see Malcolm McDowell play Gandhi.
Wasn't Malcolm McDowell in Fist of the North Star?
Yes, he was. And when you start hating on Fist of the North Star, I'm getting into my... No, wait, my van's
speaking of movies that desperately need, you know, adult film
rip-offs. Gary Daniels. Oh, yeah.
Axel Stone presents Fist of the North Star.
Oh,
punches them with his dick right. So hard, their heads explode.
All right. Just go. Go
going
on
to dark places. We're going
bring it back. Let's bring
that's
it back.
The point, Steve.
Look what you've done, Steve. Michael McVay.
A Sound of Thunder. Let's bring it back. If you're interested in all what I have to say, go to Google Images or whatever the corporate sponsor that we have. Bing, is that who's sponsoring us?
No, definitely not Bing.
Yeah. I'm gonna do what I just did type in Sound of
type
Thunder
in,
Catfish.
Type in Sound of Thunder. Ben Kingsley, and check out the Pompadour.
Shit, I'm doing it right now.
It is a thing of beauty.
No, it isn't.
Oh my God, he looks like Wayne Newton. And in the picture, he looks like he's swinging his arms from side to side, like he's excited about something.
He's quite entertaining. I thought.
He looks like he's saying jolly good.
He looks like he's getting ready to go out for Halloween as Bob Barker.
Yep, exactly. If you like laughable special effects, uneven performances, dinosaurs.
The look on Edward Burns' face is like, what the fuck happened to my career?
What am I doing in this movie?
I thought
I was an acclaimed indie writer-director.
He did. He went. He found himself. Now he's shooting stuff on the Canon 5D Mark II or 3 or whatever the kids use these days to shoot things. And
7D.
He's come to his senses, you know. And you know. Well, actually, I think the 5D Mark II has a larger sensor than the 7D.
It may. Less cropping for sure.
Full frame. It's full frame for all you folks at home that are techno dorks, but. Yeah.
In the post stage. Hey, have you guys seen Tech War?
Listen, motherfucker, I love Tech War.
Wasn't there a hockey scene in Tech War, like when they're playing in like a futuristic hockey arena or something?
Dude, it was Canadian TV. There was hockey all over that shit. I'm pretty sure Sheena Easton as War Bride had a hockey stick on her back.
They couldn't even make a buddy cop movie without having a hockey subplot in there.
No, the worst part of that movie is the other character, like the names of the characters that were being murdered. I'm pretty sure one of them's name was Cheese Butt.
No. That movie was awesome.
Awesomely terrible.
No, it was pretty awesome.
While we're on the subject, I
refuse to live in a world where I have to be forced to shit all over Running Scared, and you're allowed to defend Bone Cop, Bad Cop.
That was a damn funny movie, man.
Just while we're on the subject, real quick, best future sport in a film other than Rollerball has got to be
future sport with Dean Cain.
I was going to go with Paul Verhoeven's version of football in Starship Troopers. That's just amazing.
Foot basketball or whatever the hell it is.
Foot football. Basket foot.
I think it's called back football.
Back soccer.
Everybody put on your sport sacks.
You know, I just want a future where I can have a nice co-ed shower, you know. Give me RoboCop. Give me Starship Troopers. I can't wait for this Verhoeven episode.
Let's drop the Heinz.
Anyways, moving on.
Hurting thoughts. Let's go.
Yeah. Any last thoughts on Peter Himes? Whoever wants to speak up, go right ahead.
I'm going to say he's a solid craftsman. But, you know, it's telling that he says he's a photographer first and a director second because...
He's a solid craftsman who's made a shit ton of crappy movies.
Mm-hmm. He's made some good ones, but I don't think he has a good sense of drama or handling acting or characters. And it shows he doesn't put a lot of thought into the details of his plots. A lot of them fall apart when you start thinking about them afterwards or during. He's not a subtle guy, but again, you know, he's got a distinctive look. He's done some cool stuff. I would watch The Relic again.
The Relic is awesome.
I haven't seen that since the 90s, so after you guys raving about it, I guess I should go back and look at it.
Go read my Blu-ray review on DVDverdict.com.
Oh, it's out on blue?
Yep.
Interesting.
It's actually a pretty good blue.
It's not bad. Picture's not great, but it's not bad.
What the really shocked me about it is... I always hate seeing a movie that a studio promoted the shit out of and then another studio releases the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
Because the Relic is released by Lionsgate.
The Lionsgate.
But, I mean, I remember Paramount was promoting the shit out
Universal.
Of the Relic.
It was originally a Universal film.
Okay.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well, did they lose money on this?
No.
On the Relic?
The Relic didn't make back its budget.
Lionsgate is the kind of studio that saves, likes its hardcore and puts it out there, right?
Yep.
The Relic cost $60 million to make, and it made less than 40.
Oh, okay.
Bummer.
That's a lot of money to put into that movie.
Mm.
Yeah. Especially for an R-rated. Yeah.
I think part of the problem with The Relic is they threw a shit ton of money at the what's the big museum in New York called? Museum of Natural History?
Yeah.
Monster Museum.
Yeah, they threw a shit ton of money. That's where the book is set, and. The museum felt it was the administration in the book is really, really ripped apart.
Yeah.
So they didn't want to film it. They had to offer a shit ton of money to the museum in Chicago where they actually filmed it.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think a lot of their budget actually went towards just securing that set.
Could be.
You know what's interesting how you mentioned that? You know how... Because I didn't know that the Museum of Natural History dealing with, you know, turning down the film to draw an interesting parallel. Capricorn 1, wherein NASA is essentially played as a villain, gave resource support to the filmmakers. They allowed the filmmakers to use, I think, some of their junked technology, or I'm not really too sure what the...
Like, okay, you can have the helicopters looking at each other, but you can't have animated faces on them.
Oh, yeah. There's a really great... Yeah, he's talking about this great shot in Capricorn 1 where the helicopters... There's these two black helicopters...
It's not just one shot. It's like five.
Yeah, where anytime it's implied that they're communicating with one another. They're essentially silent.
Anytime they don't see someone and they pause sort of over a spot to add some tension.
Yeah, they turn and face each other and then flex.
Gaze lovingly into one another's eyes.
I am.
You know, if they had put a scene like that into Blue Thunder, it would have been the perfect movie.
I like Himes. I think he's a strong visualist. I think he makes some pretty damn entertaining films. I enjoyed, Outland is amazing. The Relic is amazing. I really enjoyed 2010. I really enjoyed Hanover Street. There's a lot more by him that I like than I dislike, but then his bad stuff for me really kind of, you know, is bad.
It's like pooping
and not,
in your mouth.
And not they came from the North bad. Like.
No, it's, you know.
Yes, okay, yeah, guys, you're listening to a podcast where I'm pretty sure that 75% of us will champion Steven D'Souza's Street Fighter as a cinematic triumph.
But no, for every hit, there's a miss, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's some stuff there that, like, people generally don't hold in really high regard that I still enjoyed. Like, I thought The Musketeer was a bit of fun. I really enjoyed the remake of Narrow Margin.
Great fights in The Musketeer.
Some really good stuff. And like the Musketeer almost had this, you know, this Hong Kong cinema influence going with the action scenes that I really liked.
When I saw trailers for that, I thought for sure that Luc Besson had directed.
Yeah, exactly. It was very.
I do believe Choi Harrick was actually involved in it quite a bit.
Oh, he might have done the fight choreography or whatever, but it had that Hong Kong action feel to it, you know? Mm-hmm. It was a pretty entertaining flick. But, I mean, most of his stuff has that entertainment value to it, and even some of the stuff, like, I mean, yeah, no, I'm not the biggest of Running Scared fans, but it has its moments. You know, I really enjoyed the Star Chamber. I really enjoyed the Presidio. I really enjoyed, like, the Relic. End of Days had moments that I liked, but overall, you know, kind of fell flat for me. But then you have stuff like Sound of Thunder and, well, Time Cop and Sudden Death, which I can't get behind at all.
No. End of Days is uglier than Time Cop. I will not hear otherwise.
So, you know, in the end, I guess to clue it up, I have to say I recommend people track down some of Peter Hyams' stuff. Look for his
Outland.
Especially Outland, especially 2010. His sci-fi stuff in particular, Capricorn 1. Check it out. It's good stuff, you know, but for the love of God, do not watch A Sound of Thunder. Just don't do it. Don't.
Time waves.
I've got some things to say now.
But we're out of time.
Well, let me say a few things. If you will, my Canadian overlords, please.
Keep it brief, damn it.
I speak
Canada's boxer shorts.
Hey, you guys invented the hockey hair. We just copied it. We call it the mullet. I don't know what you guys call it.
Hockey hair.
What do we call it? Mulletus Rex.
We call it the Rousedauer. But anyway.
Our greatest contribution to culture is the Lanny McDonald.
The hero of any hour.
Okay, so as I was watching in prep of this podcast, I wrote down a couple of things that I see consistently in Peter Hyams' work. I just want to share them real quick. Countdown clocks. He frequently uses countdown clocks in his film. We've got usually he has, and not all the time, but he usually has a British or a foreign female love interest, be it the character or the actress. I thought that was interesting. In the beginning of his films, he uses text often to establish. I mean, if you think of the beginning of Outland, it basically has the same thing that Alien does, where Alien describes the Nostromo, Outland describes the
you're right, you know, the mining installation.
Yeah, we're on Io.
Yeah,
this is the population. This is, you know, he does that for quite a few of his films. You know, he's got a lot of his fights are quick cut. I'm thinking Sudden Death, Outland. You know, I think he does it right. You know, I think. I'm not confused when I watch them in the way that I am with some of the directors who employ quick cutting, where my geography is a little,
I think he's a bit more consistent.
Confused
in sort of paying attention to axis and things like
and
that.
He can definitely make a crackerjack action scene.
And I think that comes from his technical prowess as a photographer or a cinematographer. You can make the argument that in film, you're either creatively inclined or technically inclined, and the people that excel at film are both creative and technically inclined. Overall, Hyams is a cinematographer. I mean, he shoots his own stuff. He tends to write a lot of his stuff, and he is also a director, and I don't know of too many people that do that. I mean, Steven Soderbergh comes to mind, but, you know, I think Soderbergh has more of a grip on the storytelling.
Rodriguez.
The acting. Yeah, Rodriguez is another jack of all.
And I don't like either one of them as much as I like Peter Hyams.
Yeah. Jack of all shit.
Yeah. Jack of all thunder. I think that where he excels tends to be in the entertainment value and not so much as the logic of his films or the storytelling or the character. But he certainly does know how to put together an entertaining story. And he does say some stuff sometimes. And I really like he's definitely got a very distinctive look to his stuff, you know. He uses the long lenses quite a bit. He uses smoke and steam and those Ridley staples, you know, shafts of light and, you know,
reflective floors.
Yeah, especially in space, right? And then, you know, he uses almost like how when you watch a Jackie Chan film, Jackie Chan isn't using guns or anything. He's using like a mop, or he's using bizarre objects, you know. In his fights, he tends to, I'm thinking Outland with the French fryer and pretty much everything in sudden death, you know. He's using silly props, you know, which are kind of fun and funny, and I think that's pretty interesting. One of the things that I really noticed that he does well, and I noticed this in Outland, and I really noticed this in Capricorn One, he is very good at the slow zoom. And I mean the slow zoom.
The tracking zoom. Mm-hmm.
In Capricorn One, he's using the zoom during Hal Holbrook's speech in the very beginning about, you know, why they're essentially doing everything that they're doing. Why have they whisked these astronauts away from their launch? And he's explaining the budgetary concerns and everything at play, the politics at play. And during the scene, you hardly notice it, but it starts with an over-the-shoulder with Brolin, Brew, or Brewbaker, one vowel away from being Bro, but he's got this over-the-shoulder long lens, and he takes you in so slowly during this speech that, I mean, I think that really contributes to what Andrew was talking about earlier about Holbrook really bringing something to his performances, you know. And I think in that case,
it was definitely supported by the camera work.
That's Himes really, really giving, and certainly he probably spoke about that before the scene, you know, about how the scene was blocked and what is going on. I mean, he strikes me as somebody who storyboards, and I can't, you know, I have no confirmation on that whatsoever. I'm just guessing based on, I mean, how nice everything really looks. I mean, he's clearly a man of good vision. I'm thinking the beginning shots of 2010 with the satellite dishes and how during the progression, and these are all, and these are all dialogue scenes, and, you know, his dialogue scenes are interesting. In some cases, Outland in particular, he's talking with Dr. Lazarus, you know, in the racquetball court. I think it's Lazarus, or it might be Seeking.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're referencing if you watch every Himes film up until I think it's what the heck is it, the one with Gene Hackman, Narrow Margin. Even after that, Stay Tuned had a Seeking cameo, and I don't remember if Time Cop or Sudden Death or the rest of them did. I'm sure he's in there somewhere, but, you know, in each one of these films, Seeking is in there. In Stay Tuned, it's a little tiny commercial in the very beginning. Narrow Margin is an expanded role. I don't know about the Presidio or Running.
Sure, he's in there.
Yeah, 2010. I'd have to think about that one. In Outland, obviously expanded role. Capricorn One, he's got his hand on the button there. But you know, in Outland, when he's having that conversation with Seeking in the racquetball court, it's either him or Lazarus. My memory is fuzzy on that, but all I remember is the intensity of the conversation was brought up to 11 by the slow zoom, and by the time that we're arriving on the close up of the face, I mean, he's conveyed the impact of, and he's using it during scenes where he needs to heighten the emotion or really pull you in, and he's explaining things like either it's plot exposition or it's character motivation, and it's always employed during dialogue scenes, and I really admire that about his films. He's got a certain restraint that he uses on those, and that I think, in addition to, you know, his attention to the visual, I think is what really strikes me about him as a filmmaker. And mostly I see him as an entertainer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's my two cents there.
Nice. Very nice.
All right.
So I'm assuming we announced now how next week we're starting our month of fright.
Sheer abject terror.
And who's our first of our horror directors to be tackled in the month of Halloween?
Dario Argento.
I think I just threw up a little.
The director that actually caused Steve and John to start bleeding from their brains.
We literally
sponsored by Gabriel Girard.
Threw a copy of Suspiria on the floor and went full on Office Space on it.
We did. There are there are pictures to prove.
There are axes involved, a shotgun.
But you know what? You guys, you got to get in there.
The dialectic makes it interesting, yeah.
The goblin does not.
I guess the only thing left...
Oh, goblin's amazing. Don't you dare.
I guess the only thing left to say then is...
See you next Wednesday.
See you next Wednesday?
See you next Wednesday.
There we go.
Well, you won't see me next Wednesday.
You never know. We're out?
Are we?
Are we?